You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for a reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines around our region this past week. Our panelists today are Scott McIntosh and Nicole Foy, both with the Idaho Statesman, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right, Scott, let's start with you, and let's talk about Boise and the State of the City address that happened earlier this week.
Yeah, so Mayor Dave Beter gave his State of the City address this week. And, you know, the two big things that came out of it were this Boise Climate Now initiative to reduce single occupancy vehicle trips in the city of Boise by 10%. Try to introduce electric vehicles, electric buses in the fleet, electric vehicles in the city fleet. Talked about reducing homelessness. He said that there are 166 homeless families in Boise, and really kind of, you know, asked the group, the audience, to try to help the city reduce homelessness for eliminate homelessness for these homeless families. So those were the two big things. And, you know, I've covered many, many States of the City addresses, and, you know, this was pretty standard fare. I think, you know, he hit the highlights and did the job that a mayor is supposed to do when they do a State of the City. I think there were, I wrote a column this week right after the State of the City, you know, saying that there were a lot of things that he didn't talk about, you know, things like rising property taxes, which I think is becoming a bigger and bigger issue in the Treasure Valley. He didn't talk about the library project at all. Didn't talk about the ballpark. You know, there were a lot of things from the speech last year that were highlighted that, you know, never came to fruition and were not mentioned at this year's speech. So overall, you know, kind of a standard, typical State of the City address, some big initiatives, but no real surprises.
And it's not surprising that things like the library and the stadium were not brought up, hence that there is so much controversy around those, and we're heading into an election.
Yeah, you know, and I obviously at a State of the City address, you're not going to talk about the negatives. You're
right.
Not going to, you know, highlight negative things. But I think it would be refreshing to see a mayor at least acknowledge some of the challenges that are on a lot of people's minds. So I think, you know, as I wrote in my column this week, that you know, it would be at least an acknowledgement that these are some of the concerns that people have, and say, you know, I'm aware of these things, and we're going to take them head on. Mm-hmm. But he didn't do that at his speech.
So Kevin, the Trump Education Department's U.S. tour made a stop in Idaho.
Yes. So, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and her top deputies are fanning around the country these past few days, touring schools. And as you might expect, touring schools with an emphasis on school choice, on alternatives to your traditional public schools. So Mitchell Zase, who is DeVos's chief deputy, and don't worry, I had to look him up online too, because I didn't know much about him. Was in Idaho Monday. He toured two schools. He toured One Stone, which is an independent high school in downtown Boise. He doesn't receive state or federal funding. And then he toured Elevate Academy, which is a new charter school in Caldwell, catering largely to an at-risk student population and trying to provide career technical education for those for their students. One of the things that really kind of struck me about the tour was what we as reporters were not allowed to see or hear. At one point on the One Stone tour, he spent probably about an hour meeting with a group of students, I want to say about 9 or 10 students, and I was ready to pull up a chair and listen to what the students had to say about their experience, the move from a traditional school maybe to a private school. And one of Zase's staffers told me, well, we really don't want reporters sitting in on this because we want the students to speak candidly. So I, you know, did what reporters do when they're kicked out after, you know, giving a dirty look or something like that. I just sat down and started to write what I could write from the tour that was open. And a few minutes later, I had one of the One Stone staffers come up to me and say, you know, you can sit in and listen to our students. That's fine. And I was like, well, actually, I don't think I'm welcome to sit there and hear from your students. And it's really kind of, it was I would have liked to have heard that conversation. It would have been interesting to see how that went and to hear what the students had to say. And it kind of reminded me, Nicole, you were there a few months ago when Ivanka Trump and Tim Cook from Apple went to Wilder schools to tour, and media access was much more limited even than what I experienced on Monday. And it's just, it's the strange sort of thing where the guests, the VIP guests, kind of dictate what the terms of the visit are going to be. And, you know, in my sense, again, from Winstone, was that the staff, you know, didn't really have a problem with reporters hearing from the students. I kind of doubt that the students had an issue with, would have had an issue with reporters being there. I spoke to one of the students afterwards, and she spoke pretty candidly about her move to Winstone.
Well, that's it.
Very interesting, very, very odd choice to keep reporters out of that.
Well, I was going to say, that's interesting, too, because saying that, oh, that we want the, you know, students to be candid, we shouldn't forget that Winstone had a documentary film crew in their school for an entire year.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're used to being followed by cameras and all. I mean, honestly.
And the niche that Winstone is trying to fill of all schools is a student-driven school. I mean, it has a school board that is comprised at least two-thirds of students.
Mm-hmm.
They really push the idea of students are going to have a key role in determining what this school does and how this school operates. So for a student-driven school to, you know, not allow, you know, to have a setting where reporters aren't allowed to hear what the students are saying to a top education department official seemed really odd, especially because it wasn't coming from the school.
And it is difficult when you have these high-profile visits from, you know, top education officials. It seems to be the trend. And, you know, local reporters don't have as much access just because we know these schools. Like, we report on them. We have very important questions. And you know, it is kind of strange not to, you know, if you're going to visit a local school and highlight something happening in a local school, why not let in people who...
Why not highlight what's happening at the local
school?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That's the thing, especially when the school's open to it as well.
So speaking of schools, Scott, College of Western Idaho, what is new there? You wrote an interesting article about
this. Yeah, the saga continues. You know, so this week, the Board of Trustees for College of Western Idaho met, and on the agenda was an item about capital projects. And, of course, over the past several years, 4 or 5 years, the college has tried to build new buildings through various means, through a bond 3 years ago that failed at the polls. They tried a levy a couple of years ago, and that also failed at the polls. They floated this summer a proposal to either go back to voters or raise fees or look for money elsewhere to build smaller buildings. And so we were kind of expecting an update this week. And really, they are going to wait until next month. They're going to do another presentation on October 15th where they're going to go over the history of how we got to where we are. They've got a couple new board members. They've got new administrative faculty or staff members on the administration. And so I wrote a column this week saying, you know, they should sell their land, the 10 acres of land that they purchased in downtown Boise in the West End. They could probably get $10 million or $15 million. They bought it for $8.8 million. It's probably worth a little more now. And they were promised $10 million from the state legislature to build new buildings. You know, if they could cobble together $20 or $30 million, then they could build classroom and office space on their Nampa campus. And I think that, personally, I think that that's the way to go, is to consolidate, get out of some of these expensive leases that they have all over Ada County, have one location where all students go to and have all services in one location in a campus in Nampa. Now, whether they listen to me or not, I don't know
why they wouldn't.
Well, that's what I always think.
Right.
So we'll see. You know, they're going to meet on October 15th and go over this presentation and then go from there and see what they decide, what the board members decide.
Hmm. And then there's something going on with their mascot.
Yeah. So they brought Board Chairman Skip Smizer, he brought this up at the end of the meeting, and I give him all the credit in the world for this. He says, you know, we've been around for 10 years at least, and we never got a mascot. We don't have a mascot. So there's no.
Do they have teams?
they don't have sports teams, and but I still feel that it creates a sense of identity. It's good for fundraising. It's good for alumni morale. You know, you've got 10 years now of alumni.
And they're just College of Western Iowa.
They're just College of Western. So, you know, I put out there, you know, maybe the College of Western Iowa Falcons, maybe the Giant Salamanders.
Oh.
I don't know if that'll fly, or the Mountain Bluebird, that my favorite. So we'll see. Mark Dunham and Molly Lenti, board members, are going to put together a committee, and over the next 2 months, 3 months, try to come up with some recommendations, and then come back in December at the board meeting and see if there's some recommendations and see if by 2020 we have a mascot for College of Western Idaho.
Because as we've seen in K-12, there's never anything controversial about ever. Mascots. These
ever.
Things I doubt, never come back to haunt
I doubt. I doubt it'll be the Braves. Just a guess.
I
think you're probably right.
But someone might take issue with a salamander or something. You never know. Let's stay on education. And Kevin, teacher pay raises. Are we going to see a battle in this in the State House?
We could.
Up in January?
We definitely could. So what we've seen unfolding over the past few weeks, and another development on this on Thursday with Governor Little's Education Task Force, a subcommittee of the task force recommended that the state should move towards a maximum teacher payout of $60,000 for the most veteran teachers in the state. That is an idea that's been around for at least 6 years. It was recommended in 2013 by Governor Otter's task force. It never happened, but you're seeing increased momentum towards the idea of putting more money into salaries, especially the pay pool for veteran teachers, because the career ladder, which we've had for the past 5 years, put a lot of money into teacher pay, $250 million. But it was sort of front-loaded into the system to help beginning teachers and teachers who maybe are just a couple or a few years into their careers. But it didn't do a whole lot to improve pay for veteran teachers. So that's the issue right now. State Superintendent Sherry Ibarra has proposed to put $40 million into this right away. The task force is saying, well, it may take some time. Layering into all of that, you've got a report from the Idaho Freedom Foundation, who is arguing that they think that the original career ladder hasn't really worked anyway, and the last thing the state should do is to extend it or do more in the way of a teacher pay plan. You know, their report comes out, and, you know, as I pointed out in my story on Thursday, I think whenever the Freedom Foundation talks about education, you do have to go back to the fact that Wayne Hoffman, the president of the Freedom Foundation, is on record saying that he questions whether the state should even be in the business of paying for public education. He said that in a piece a few months ago. He definitely has an opinion on this. The foundation definitely has an opinion, but they have the ear of some pretty conservative legislators, especially in the House. You add all that up, you factor in that it's a tight budget year next year. I think there will be a battle over teacher pay and what to do next. Because for 5 years, the legislature has been pretty much on the same page in terms of funding this career ladder. I don't think that it's the same dynamic moving forward.
Well, and adding in that money was just to kind of catch up from the freezes that they had before.
During the recession, right? Mm-hmm.
And I just remember moving here to Idaho, in 06 and talking to teachers who had 30, 35, 40 years experience, and they're maxing out at $53,000 a year. So imagine being, 60 years old, you've been in your career and you're really good at your job, and the most you can make is $53,000. I found that pretty stunning.
Right.
And so this would, at least in part, address some of that.
And when you talk to administrators, they'll say those are the teachers we really want to keep in the classroom. Those are the teachers who have experience. They're leaders in their schools. They're the teachers you want your kids to be go into class with, and they're the teachers you really want to try to figure out how to retain. You want to keep them teaching in Idaho as opposed to going on to another state or another or to go into administration simply to make a pay increase.
And Kevin, I want to pick up the conversation with you regarding the latest on all-day kindergarten.
What we tried to do with this, and when I say we, our intern, Cameron Arnston, spent most of his summer working on this, contacting school districts and charters across the state, trying to get a sense of how many offer all-day kindergarten to at least some of their students, as opposed to how many are offering pre-K programs to some or all of their students. And the numbers were really kind of surprising. we weren't able to reach out and get contact from every district in Charter, but we found that at least 81 of Idaho's 115 school districts offer all-day kindergarten to at least some of their kids. And some offer universal all-day kindergarten to everybody. And what was even more interesting, maybe, is how they're paying for it.
Mm.
Because you got to remember, the state only provides funding for half-day kindergarten, which is still optional anyway. So if you're going to provide all-day kindergarten to kids, some kids or all kids, you have to figure out how to pay for the rest. And what we found was that districts and charters are using some of their general funds. They're moving some money around, maybe using some federal dollars or some state money. They're going to voters and saying, if you will pay for, if you will approve a supplemental tax levy, we'll use your property tax money to expand kindergarten offerings. Some are using that literacy money that the state has provided with the idea of helping at-risk students. So that's been a funding source as well. Very few are actually going to parents and saying, well, if you want all-day kindergarten, you got to pay the balance. You've got to pay the difference. Very few tuition-based programs. And I think what that tells us is that administrators feel like this is a valuable service. This is a valuable offering, but we don't want it to become means-based. If we're going to offer this, we want all kids, regardless of their economic station, to be able to take advantage.
So a question then, though, is if school districts, you know, they're cobbling together funding somehow, some way to make this work, where does the argument come in then, trying to get the state to actually do their part and fund all-day kindergarten? Because could legislators potentially say, well, look, you're figuring it out. Why do you need us?
Well, that's a good question. But I think that the fact that districts and charters are having to cobble this together, it kind of raises the argument. When I did this story, I talked to Beth Oppenheimer with the Association for the Education of Young Children, an advocate for pre-K and also for all-day kindergarten. She said, look, you have districts that are relying on fundraising or they're relying on tax levies that go 1 or 2 years. We've got to have something more consistent. Well, something more consistent could cost tens of millions of dollars. And we talked in the first segment about how money's going to be tight in the next legislative session for teacher pay raises. Money's going to be tight for all-day kindergarten as well.
And there are districts that are not doing it. And so when you talk about the state providing a uniform education system, that is really in serious question.
Well, and you bring up the point that it is going to be a tight session financially. But this comes up over and over again. And even if you look at any research and the value of all-day kindergarten, but yet it's not even, as you said, Kevin, it's not required to even go to kindergarten in the state of Idaho.
And right, it's not required even at the half day level,
right,
at the all day level. But you have school districts, school administrators saying that they really feel like this is the next step that has to be taken. I spent some time in CUNA last week, where they've gone to all day kindergarten. They're in their second year of all day kindergarten.
And this is universal kindergarten in CUNA.
Right.
Yes.
And they were encouraged by what they saw in the first year, and they're really encouraged by what they're seeing in the second year. I spoke to one of the first grade teachers, and she said, I've got kids that are reading. I've got kids that they learned a lot more in their kindergarten classes, and they retained it. They didn't come back after the summer having to relearn a whole lot of stuff. So they're really encouraged, but they're also realizing that they're having to cobble together the money.
Right.
They're using that literacy money that I talked about to pay for most of the program. Well, the catch-22 there is that funding is distributed based on how many students you have that aren't reading at grade level. So the better you do, if this really works,
the
less money you get from the state, and the more you have to figure out how to keep it going. It's a challenge.
Nicole, let's talk about the you have a partnership going on with Idaho Ed News this year, and this is regarding Latino education.
Yeah, this is a really good point that Kevin is making, because this is something specifically when you look at the effect on, on kindergarten education, it has a dramatic effect on several of the special groups that have significant gaps, whether you're talking about economically disadvantaged students or homeless students or Latino students. And so this year, actually, the Statesman is partnering with Idaho Ed News, myself and reporter Sammy Edge. We are taking a school year long project to look at why are there still persistent gaps between Latino students in Idaho, Idaho's largest minority group in schools. There are about 18% in Idaho schools now. And why is there a consistent gap between their achievement gaps at every level? Well, we're talking about graduation rates, English, math, science. They still drag pretty far behind white students in schools. And that's really concerning when you have the Latino population, such a growing population scattered across the state, and a consistently younger, skewing younger than other demographics in the state. And so we're taking a school year long project to go and talk to school districts, talk to teachers and parents and students, and especially this fall, we're spending a lot of time, as much time as we can in schools, just wanting to know what's working, what's not working, what do parents think is the problem, what do students think is the problem, and where are the bright spots? We know there are bright spots. We know that there are certain schools that are succeeding really well, but we also know that part of the likely contributing factor to this is that representation is pretty sparse when it comes to educators. You know, if you look at the 10 school districts with the highest Latino populations in the state, less than 10% of their teachers are Latino. So it comes back to retention and teacher pay, mm-hmm. and all these issues kind of come together. And of course, Idaho's not the only state that's struggling with achievement gaps in the Latino population, but it's definitely something we want to take a look at and see what should we be talking about? What should be in front of legislators? Because some of these issues we've been talking about for 40 years in this state. Some gaps have closed. Graduation rate is one, but still there are, 75% graduation rate for Latinos and 80% for white students. It's a much smaller gap than it used to be, but we're talking about a go-on rate. We're talking about, lots of things that we believe are necessary for students to succeed. If you're not looking at the Latino population, you're missing a significant aspect of the state's students.
And Scott, I want to wrap up with you about the latest with the Canyon County Jail.
Yeah, so the jail trailers, the temporary jail trailers that the county ordered to bring in to house female inmates, they still have not arrived yet. They were supposed to be installed by June, and now they're saying it's going to be the end of October. So they're continuing to scramble. Ruth Brown wrote a story this week that documented a suicide attempt at the jail annex. Because of the overcrowding issues, they have a lot of female inmates housed in the jail annex. And this is an older building, 1948 it was built, and just is not...
It's not up to par at all.
Right.
Nicole, you've covered this too.
There's low visibility as far as, so it's not the safest for either inmates or staff, and it's very old. There's not enough space even for the amount of manpower that it takes to staff this area. And if you take a tour of it, it's pretty dismal. Any jail's not going to be a great place to be, but it's definitely a problem in that jail, and one that they're actively trying to address, of course.
Yeah, and this illustrates the problem. This was a woman who was in jail for a felony DUI, and she took a bed sheet and wrapped it around a cage that surrounded a fire sprinkler. She was able to pull a chair over, and deputies saved her life. But it just illustrates how dangerous that is. Mm-hmm. And so we still have some more time to wait for these jail trailers. And even once they arrive, then they still have to be installed and hooked up to utilities. And so we're probably looking into the beginning of next year before they'll be able to move.
Do they know why it's so behind schedule?
I don't know. I don't know why.
State permitting is what has been the report.
That's been the report.
But it is, it's a completely new system. They're
right.
Building jail trailers, these trailers in the parking lot. There are several other Idaho jails on the list, but Canyon County is going to be the first one. And there's only
we'll see if it works.
I think that's pretty much, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like many other states across the country, Idaho has a skyrocketing female incarcerated population, and that's specifically what these jail trailers are going to address, so that they can close areas like the annex that, you know, they would rather not be housing any inmates.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today. We're going to leave on a happy note with jail. Anyway, thank you so much for coming in. Our guest today, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman. Always great to have you guys come in on a Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, we're going to go to the Wood River Valley, talk to the theater company, Company of Fools, about a unique program that they're putting into place. I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters.